welcome to the Film Fringe Podcast, a show about movies on the margins. Every episode, we'll try to highlight lesser-known films, new and old, in hopes of shining some light on them. My name is Matthew McCrary. I'm your host, and I'm here with my buddy,
Keith Burton.
And this is our first episode. We're going to be talking about some of the films of 2013 and some of our favorite things we watched this year and not-so-favorite things. So I think first we're going to start off with a convo, a little bit of a back and forth about the film Gravité.
Yeah, I think some people call that a dialogue.
Yeah, some people do call that a dialogue. All right, so Keith, why don't you lead us off? I think this is your film.
Yeah, Gravity is probably going to end up being my top one or two of 2013. The director was Alfonso Cuarón, how do you say it in Spanish correctly?
Cruton, I think it's Cruton.
Cruton, yeah. He's a director who's known for his breakout movie, I'm terrible with Spanish, E Tu Mamba Tambien.
I think it's E Tu Mamba Tambien.
Tambien. But now he's a director that's good with like character studies. He's less plot-driven in the past, but Gravity is his first sci-fi like special effects big blockbuster movie. And
well, no, but he did do No Children for
No Children.
No Country for Old Children. He did do. Hit me.
Children of Men.
Children of Men.
Yeah, which I liked. And it was a big hit in America and the UK. Gravity is a different beast because it's heavily special effects, more so than the past movies. It's basically all special effects. And it's one of those movies that I really feel like to enjoy, you have to see in theaters and you have to see in 3D, which I would never say for any other movie, but definitely for Gravity. Matt, before we get into like the plot and all the details, like, what's your overview of Gravity? What do you think?
I don't get it.
You don't get it? Okay. Were you just underwhelmed or what?
I was underwhelmed. I think I came into it with too many expectations. But you know what? Going to the CGI thing real quick, I actually read that it has like 80% CGI. So it actually has more CGI in it than Avatar.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. But Gravity was real pretty, but I didn't. Like, what is it? What's it saying?
I think it's basically, it's not saying a lot. Like, this is not a deep philosophical movie, but at its core, it's a survival tale. It's basically just pointing out that humans will go to great lengths to stay alive and to make it back safely. And that's really the core of it. It's nothing deeper than that. And he did kind of load it with imagery that suggests things like there's a shot where in a fetal position.
Yeah, I got that. There's like a rebirth rate going on.
Yeah, rebirth narrative that goes throughout the movie, but it's really not trying to say anything beyond that, really. I think it's just a movie about somebody trying to stay alive, the lengths they'll go to do that, you know, based on reality.
Well, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is we're about 5 minutes from the ISS, and I know where the Russians stash their vodka. And that is good, because I'm running on fumes here. The bad news is, I'm going to be about 10 minutes short of breaking Anatoly's record. What?
I'm redlining. My O2 tank pressure is low.
Your tank is out of oxygen, but you still have it in your suit.
Got it.
So you have to sip, not gulp. Wine, not beer. Sip, Ryan.
I'm okay with a really sparse plot and a really sparse narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, as you were just saying, I like the rebirth stuff. That was probably some of my favorite parts. But I guess for me, one of the issues, like, I felt sort of like, what's she going back to? But I guess that's sort of the entire point of the whole rebirth. And with the end of the movie, how she's almost walking for the first time, you sort of kind of is what he's getting at, I think. And I was reading something that said that the last scene is actually the only part of the film that's shot in film.
Yeah.
The rest is shot in digital. Yeah. And it's 65 millimeter too. So I thought that was interesting that he wanted to purposely make that difference there between visual cues, I guess, the type of film he was using.
Yeah, and the ending
scene. Or medium he was using, I guess.
Yeah, the ending scene is not subtle. Like,
yeah.
Heavy dramatic music. She's like crawling on the beach. That old pictures of evolution in textbooks were like, you know, crawling out of the lake on
Mm-hmm.
It's like an evolution kind of thing, but that was all really heavy-handed. And I honestly, that was my least favorite part of the whole movie. I mean,
really, that's yeah. probably one of my more favorites. Like, as the shot was just so beautiful, and this is amazing.
Yeah, it looked great. It sounded great, but I was more blown away by the visual effects in space.
Uh-huh.
And just if you want to talk real quick, like, how did you see Gravity? I think that is everything. Like, what did you see it on?
Oh, I saw it on a wonderfully gigantic, beautiful, you know, HD Max screen
yeah.
in my house.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is an argument to be made that if a movie can't be seen on any screen and still be enjoyable, then it may be a lesser movie for that. But
that's the argument I would make. But, I mean, you know, like, I'm really into the screenplay and stuff. So, for me, it's like, if it doesn't hold up in my home, you know, and it's not that Gravity is a bad movie. It's actually a pretty good movie. It's just like, it annoys me how much people love it,
yeah.
just because I don't feel like it has as much to say as some of my favorite movies of the year that aren't being talked about as much, that have a lot to say. But that's sort of me just being an asshole.
No, and I understand that. And
that I'm an asshole?
No. I feel like you would have a totally different opinion than had you seen it in theaters, which is going to sound like me being a snob or whatever, but to see that on a three dimensions on a huge screen that wraps around your vision,
mm-hmm.
and to see like the pieces of the satellites going by, the pieces, all it's just hard to describe. Like, it's
yeah.
so much
it's an experience.
Yeah, and like when the camera rotated with her movements and followed her, like through the twists and the turns, like you felt that, and it was really like a total sensory experience. That's what sold it for me. It's kind of like people who watch 2001 A Space Odyssey, and if you watch that on a small screen, you're like, what's going on? This is slow, this is boring. You watch it on a huge screen in a theater, you're like, oh my god, I feel overwhelmed. Kind of thing. So it's a little bit of a difference, I think, on how it's presented.
Yeah, but I would argue that with 2001 A Space Odyssey, there's just more interesting stuff happening. Like, there's commentary on technology, there's I'm not really going to go past that, but it's interesting enough that I can watch it at home
yeah.
and maybe not be wowed by the visuals in the same way, but I'm still gripped to the film as a whole because the script is amazing, or, you know, what Kubrick's doing with the visuals is groundbreaking in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
What Alfonso Cuarón's doing is awesome, too. It just didn't affect me as much as 2001 did, for instance.
Yeah, and I think 2001, like, it was definitely trying to say something philosophical about humanity and the universe, and whatever that message might be, you know, it's kind of convoluted, but Gravity wasn't doing that, and I actually respected Gravity more because it was just really bare bones, like,
mm-hmm.
it was just a survival tale. It's like, this is basically All Is Lost, that movie that came out
yeah, yeah.
here
mm-hmm.
in space.
And it's not trying to be more than it is.
No.
Yeah, I can appreciate that.
And I feel like there was a lot of hype around the movie, and mostly because of the visuals, but I kind of disregarded that, and I just went in. Like, honestly, the only thing I've seen about Gravity is just a quick, like, teaser trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see a real trailer. I didn't really have any shots full for me. So when I saw it, like, it was a real experience, and I didn't really get any hype before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that.
How were the 3D visuals for you? They didn't seem gimmicky at all?
Not at all.
I mean, obviously, I don't really get them. So I think when you watch 3D visuals from a 2D... like, knowing that it's supposed to be a 3D movie, sometimes you sort of feel like it's kind of gimmicky. Almost like that scene from an Albert Brooks movie where he's, like, bouncing the
yeah.
paddle ball at the screen, like, hey!
Yeah, no, like, and that's the thing, is I've seen two other movies in 3D before this. I saw piece of shit movie, what was it?
Avatar?
No, the Aliens remake.
That was an awesome movie, Keith. Prometheus?
No, I hated Prometheus. I saw that in 3D, yeah, and to me, that wasn't gimmicky, but it didn't feel necessary for the film. I feel like...
Yeah, that wasn't necessary.
Yeah, the 3D of Gravity is necessary to enjoy the film, I think.
Really?
That's, yeah. I think that if you're going to see it, big theater, 3D...
That's the way to go.
Yeah, that's... Any other way, you just miss it.
We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Guards with Silver Lining. You can check out their music at InGuardsWeTrust.com. You say you took it from the bottom measure, the one and only simple pleasure now. Oh, how?
2013 wrap up.
What's your biggest surprise?
Well, my biggest surprise of the year, I have a tie. A lot of mine are ties this year. I had a tie between It's a Disaster. It was a really good disaster movie, I feel like, because as opposed to some of these other ones that you've seen, it just basically was six people who were trapped in the house. Actually, now that I think about it, it's kind of like This Is the End. But it's more couples, so it has a lot to do with these people's problems and their relationships, like, boil up to the top. The plot is that there's basically a dirty bomb dropped on I guess it's their city or a nearby city. And so the gas starts floating into their neighborhood, and they can't leave the house. And they've all come together for this dinner party. But there have been all these things that have built up over the years between each character and their relationships with one another.
Yeah.
So it just sort of plays out like, you know, if you had a dinner party with six people and there was a lot of tensions there that hadn't been discussed and you all get trapped inside of a house together, pretty much like what would happen sort of thing.
That sounds like a good premise to the movie. I haven't seen the movie yet, but it sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, well, another really nice touch to it is that David Cross plays a character who is just now dating Julia Stiles. Like, they're pretty early into the relationship.
Oh.
And so she's bringing him over to the first time. So you kind of see it from his perspective almost. It's like, you know, you're being brought into this home. So that was a nice character touch that you kind of can relate to that character.
Yeah.
My other biggest prize would probably be From Up on Poppy Hill, which was directed by Hayao Miyazaki's son, Gorō Miyazaki. Mm-hmm. So it's the newest, well, it's actually the second to newest Studio Ghibli film. And I went in knowing that his other film wasn't necessarily looked at as one of the best. In fact, a lot of people thought it was kind of a shame that Hayao Miyazaki's son hadn't been able to create something as good as Hayao Miyazaki stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But From Up on Poppy Hill was just a really great film. It was very simple in plot. So it wasn't trying to be, sort of like you mentioned, Gravity. It wasn't trying to be more than it is. It's just about these two kids. The girl's the main character that we follow, and she ends up being interested in this boy who's trying to save these clubs that are at the school, and sort of touching on the importance of the more quaint things that we've kind of taken for granted in life, like these clubs and these social communities that we can be a part of.
Was it like a coming-of-age tale, a relationship movie?
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit both. I mean, the kids are like 11 or 12, so the relationship doesn't get any... It didn't get hot or heavy or anything, but, you know.
Not looking for that.
But it's a sweet film, you know. And yeah, it was a good movie. Great.
Cool.
How about you, man? What were some of your biggest surprises?
Honestly, and this is going to be weird because I'm not a huge Michael Bay fan. Pain and Gain was the biggest surprise of the year for me just because, like, it is not a perfect film. It's got flaws, but I popped it in. Well, I didn't pop it in. I legally, quote-unquote, downloaded it. And watched it. And
from iTunes, right?
Yeah.
Very exactly. Cool.
And at first, immediately, I knew that this was not a smart film, and it wasn't trying to be, but it did have a message that it was trying to say. And this is the first Michael Bay's movie where I feel like it really narrowed into a message beyond, like, look at the explosions, or
mm-hmm.
this chick is hot, you know. He has trying to say something about the American dream, and he's doing it through two really dumb bodybuilders and their desire to get ahead really fast.
Well, three, actually.
Or three, yeah, that's true. Three, yeah. And they do it through kidnapping, extortion, and all these different, fraudulent activities. And it's a weird, trippy movie about, like, it's the late 80s, early 90s?
It's the early 90s when it takes place, yeah.
Early 90s, and you can totally tell it's all, like, so damn buff for that film.
Yeah.
And the dialogue that The Rock gives is just like, I don't know, he's a funny guy. Like,
yeah.
I didn't expect how funny he was.
Yeah, he's pretty good in it.
Yeah, and he plays, his character is kind of serious too. He's like this really guy who tries to be nice and religious and stuff, and he just keeps fucking up, and he's out of jail. And the main character, I forget his name, but played by
Mark Wahlberg.
And
the Funky Bunch. The Funky Bunch sadly aren't in this film. I really wish they were, yeah.
They always need to be, but... no, like, just to kind of rush through the plot, it was really good. The only thing that really bothered me about it was the torture scene. they kind of lingered a lot on that torture scene. It was kind of uncomfortable. I don't know if that was intentional, but I was just like, do we really need another?
Well, he's like, he's such a cruel guy, man. He likes, he's into himself some cruelty, you know?
It's like Zero Dark 30, but in the 90s.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, like, I wasn't, like, converted to his message totally, but I was like, that's a really interesting take on two really dumb characters who try to get ahead and fail.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that bad.
No, I agree with you on Panic Again. It was definitely a surprise. I don't know if Michael Bay intended for it to be, for it to say what it said, but
yeah.
I think of it, like, as a happy accident.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it made my... best movies of the year list, sorry, or anything, but it was definitely worth a watch. And I'll give it two credits, which was one, I initially started it thinking I'll watch about 30 minutes of this and then I'll finish the rest of it tomorrow night, or I'll watch 30 minutes tomorrow until I finish it, you know. And I watched the entire movie in one sitting. Like, I thought I was gonna stop it, but I couldn't. And afterwards I had to go on Wikipedia and look up the identities of these characters. So if at the very least, the story is interesting.
It definitely is.
If you don't like anything else, the story is at least interesting.
And I can see this movie being made by, like, a more quote unquote serious director, and it would have had a different tone, and it wouldn't have taken itself as lightly as this movie did. And I think that could be a good and a bad thing. Like, I think the reason Pain and Gain that Michael Bay made works is because it's just a really lighthearted movie that tries to be serious sometimes, but it really can't do that.
So it was
fun, as much fun as I've ever had looking at Michael Bay stuff.
Yeah, I think he was a good person to do it, though, for some reason. It feels like there's going to be a story about two or three bodybuilders, you know.
Yeah.
Michael Bay's the one to do it.
Definitely with cocaine.
Yeah, with plenty of cocaine.
Michael Bay has done his fair share.
Because I feel like Michael Bay is a part of, like, creating, like, the bodybuilder. I don't know, like, I feel like they go kind of hand in hand.
He's kind of a bro dude. He's like, really pro-military and all.
Yes, I feel like he's perpetuating this need to have overly masculine guys. So it's interesting that he makes a movie that's sort of questioning that masculinity in some way or another. So that makes me wonder if he even meant to, but I don't know.
Oh, well, maybe give him, like, more credit than he deserves, but...
Film Friend 2013 wrap-up.
So my biggest letdown, biggest disappointment, most overrated... first, we'll start with Fast and Furious 6, which didn't actually make it all the way through. I couldn't do it, man. I'd read so many of my, like, favorite reviewers, people who I respected, saying this was an awesome movie, and I don't get it. Like, maybe I'm just not into cars, and that's my problem. Have you seen it?
No. I
couldn't do it. There wasn't anything interesting about it, you know? And I honestly, with, like, biggest letdown, I don't know what more to say than it just wasn't good. One thing I'll give credit to Fast and Furious 6 is that it has... very, like, racially diverse cast, and I can appreciate that. But that's really, like, all it's got going for it, you know? Like, I love that Ludacris is a character who, like, he's the science guy. How often do you see the black guy as a science guy in a movie besides, like, Undercover Brother?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is the point of that movie.
Yeah.
So that I appreciate that about Fast and Furious 6, but besides that, it was so dumb.
Really?
Yeah, just so dumb.
I haven't heard anything from Ludacris in forever. Where do you go? Where's Ludacris?
Fast and Furious 6. If you were in Fast Furious 6, would you need to do anything else?
No, I feel You'd like he's good. Just falling asleep every night on money. Just stacks of money. He doesn't know where he is. Just sleeping on money.
Exactly. The other one I had was Iron Man 3, which I know you like Keith, but I just read all these things about, like, how terrific the screenplay was and all that kind of stuff. But, like, in contrast with Pain and Gain, here's this movie where you're pointing out how much of an asshole this guy is, right? But then you're making him the hero, and you're telling people that he's the one you're supposed to be following and rooting for by the end of the film. And he treats this little kid he meets like shit. Like, I just don't think it's a good message. You know what I mean? Like, Pain and Gain, the point of it is these guys aren't heroes. They're assholes, and you're supposed to see them as assholes. But I don't think you're supposed to see Tony Stark as an asshole at the end of the day.
I'm going to disagree with you there a little bit.
Do it.
Okay.
Throw it down. Right. Gauntlet.
Well, I like that movie, and the writer-director, I liked it because the Tony Stark character is kind of an asshole, and that comes from the source material in the comics. Like, he, in some comics, he's an alcoholic, he's an asshole, he's abusive, but, and I think the way that Robert Downey Jr. plays him is, especially in this movie more so than the other ones, he especially as a kid. But I think the way he treats a kid is kind of like a little tough love or a little... he's just kind of being a jerk playfully. And I don't think he's doing it in a way to totally be totally cruel to the kid.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the way he was acting in those scenes were for laughs. Like, he was trying to get laughs out of the audience. Because we watched it and it was like, who would say that shit to a kid, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't hate that movie. I didn't think it was perfect, but I really liked how many balls he was juggling, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was dealing with the kid's subplot. He was dealing with, what was the bad guy called?
The Mandarin.
The Mandarin, yeah. He was dealing with the Mandarin.
And that was so badly handled, too, man. Like,
I kind of liked it. It was just this slub that was a failed actor and didn't turn into the real guy. But I guess...
It's a cool idea, but they didn't handle it well. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I feel like the ending was rushed. Like, the whole 16 suits flying around thing.
Yeah, and Guy Pearce is such this, like, total Bond villain. I don't know. I was weird, man. I just didn't...
I liked it. And the one thing I really liked was Penny. Is her name Penny?
You're pretty close. Pepper.
Yeah. Anyway, her character, like, she was the one who actually did the final blow, kind of, to save the day. Like,
mm-hmm.
She donned one of his suits and kicked ass.
But she had to become, like, a man to do it.
Did she? I mean...
She had to become Iron Man to do it.
Well, she threw on a suit. She was Iron Woman at the time. I don't know. I thought that was interesting, though, that, like, finally she gets to do something in these movies, but...
Yeah, well, that was definitely bucking some of the trends, but, I mean, Catwoman got to do that in the last Batman film. And she was doing it pretty much the entire film.
I thought that whole movie should have been about her and not about anything else. Like, give me a Catwoman movie. Like,
I don't. They've had a Catwoman movie.
It wasn't with what their name.
That movie's outstanding, sir. I will not have you badmouth the name of Halle Berry.
No, like, these female characters, like, I really like the idea of Pepper, you know, kicking ass. And
I do too.
Taking control. Like,
but it wasn't done well.
Yeah. I mean, it had that been, like,
uh-huh.
Like, give me that.
Okay.
I did not think Iron Man 3 was badly done. It just kind of was trying to do too much.
Yes, it was trying to do way too much.
Yeah, and that's a symptom of that writer. He does that a lot. Like, mm-hmm. He tries to juggle too much. And the scripts that fail really fail because of that, and the scripts that succeed really succeed because of that.
Well, I'm not even a Lethal Weapon fan, so maybe I'm just not a fan of his stuff.
I would give the original Lethal Weapon another watch. Like, kind of a bro dude buddy cop thing, but it's got more emotional moments than you would expect for a buddy cop movie like that. Like,
yeah, it was better than I thought it'd be.
Yeah,
because I saw it for the first time about like a year ago, I guess.
Like the scene where I don't know the actor's name, crazy dude, Catholic, Mel Gibson.
Yes.
Yeah, where Mel Gibson's like sitting in his home with a gun, he's contemplating shooting himself.
Yes.
Watch that scene again.
That's pretty intense.
That is intense.
It's pretty intense.
That makes you uncomfortable.
It's like Toy Story 3 level.
Yeah. And
they're accepting their fate.
I thought that was really good.
Mm.
So he's not a bad writer, and he can get the job done, but I don't know. I just will disagree with you about Iron Man
3. All right, fine. We'll agree to disagree. All right, what's your most overrated or film or biggest disappointment or whatever you want to call it?
I think I'm going to have to select American Hustle, and I'm like literally the 1% on this because everybody loved this movie.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah, it's got like a 97 or something on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's written and directed by David Russell. I think it was
David O'Russell. Yeah.
David O'Russell, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's a guy known for Three Kings, I Heart Huckabees, and my favorite movie of last year is Silver Linings.
That's my favorite movie of all time, Keith.
Which, I Heart Huckabees?
No.
Oh.
Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh, no.
I like that movie because it really touched my soul.
Whatever. Genuinely, that was my favorite movie last year. And I thought going into this movie that I was going to get something similar, like, I guess, an emotional impact. Because it seems like that's his game now. Is in the past, he was really big on ideas, and he had these theoretical concepts he worked into movies, like mm-hmm. Die Hard, Huckabees. But with Silver Linings, it was emotional. I thought I was going to get that in this movie, and it tried, like, really wanted me to get angry, get like laugh along, or get moved by the character's actions, but
mm.
I just could not give less of a shit. Like, and it was trying to mess with genre.
Uh-huh.
It was trying to be like Goodfellas a little bit.
I'd heard that before.
Yeah, it was trying to rip off like the set pieces, the camera styles, some of the dialogue, and I just didn't buy it. Like, I thought the casting on that movie was wrong.
Really?
Yeah, I thought Jennifer Lawrence was wrong. I thought everybody except for Christian Bale and the guy who played the mayor.
Jeremy Renner?
Yeah. Those are the only two actors that I really believe were their characters. Everybody else seems like people in wigs that would just play it. Seriously, I was so impressed with him, and he was the most reserved, understated performance, but his whole character arc, like, I believed it 100%. And I was like, why wasn't the rest of the cast doing that for me? I feel like, what's his name? Bradley Cooper, who I liked a lot. I feel like he was just kind of phoning it in, and he was just being Bradley Cooper. And
he can do he's allowed to do that now.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
he's at that point.
Yeah, he's at that point. But J Law, like, I was so disappointed.
J Law!
Great
is that people are calling her now? I thought I just came up with that yesterday. I thought it was so original. Okay, go ahead.
I think she's a great actress. I think she's probably going to be one of the best. But in this movie, I just didn't believe it. I didn't believe that she was this manipulative, hateful wife that just wants money and control. And I didn't believe it. I didn't think that's who she was. Anyway.
So do you think she'll be one for our times? Do you think she'll be up there with some of the best actresses of all time, Keith?
I think so.
And what evidence do you have of that?
I really think she's somebody who puts a lot of thought into what they do. And that alone is more than most. Like, I really think she does try hard. I mean, in interviews, she laughs and pretends like she doesn't care and that kind of thing. But I really think on set, she's proven that she gives shit and she tries. And she's a good actress.
Did you like her best in Silver Linings Playbook?
Yeah, I think that's her best movie right now.
I liked her best in the original Hunger Games.
I didn't see that one.
You didn't see the original Hunger Games?
Wait, no. I saw part of that one.
Okay.
Not a big Hunger Games
guy. It's not the best movie, but I don't know. For some reason, Hunger Games was a movie that deserved her overwrought acting. Yeah. So it was like, okay, this is a good movie for her.
Oh, you think she's overwrought? She is kind of overwrought. That's what she is in American Hustle.
Yeah.
She just overacts the whole thing.
Yeah. I haven't seen American Hustle, but I kind of want to. For me, it feels like, from what I can tell from American Hustle, it seems like it's going to take itself less seriously than Silver Linings Playbook did. Which, whether you like Silver Linings Playbook or not, you have to admit it took itself seriously.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my hope, that it's good because of that, because it is a little bit more jokey with what it's trying to do, which is what I like to an extent with I Heart Huckabees, is that it's this, like, movie that's got all this crazy stuff happening, but I feel like at the end of the day, it's also kind of making fun of itself to an extent. Like, it's willing to joke around, I don't know.
Yeah, and he definitely has a sense of humor, and there are really funny parts of American Hustle, but I just didn't buy it, I don't know.
Didn't buy it?
Didn't work for me. Like, if you're going to toe that line, pick a side and do both sides, or if you're going to do both sides well. Like, you did the comedy. And that's why I didn't believe it. But
any other disappointments?
Another one, again, going against all the critics, 12 Years a Slave by a director that I love.
Racist.
Yeah, of course. That's in me. Steve McQueen, who did Hunger and Shame, two of my movies that I love. I think they're great movies, but 12 Years a Slave was a necessary movie. I guess if you're going to talk about slavery, that's how you have to do it. Like, really raw, really harsh, really punishing.
See, but I want it like Django Unchained, where it's real fun, and I get to laugh with all the characters, and everyone dies. That was a lot of fun for me.
Yeah. To me, that's like taking the Holocaust and making it into a fun and dance song. Like,
oh, you mean like that other one they did before Django Unchained?
Yeah. Exactly. Like all Tarantino's films.
But I actually like that one. Okay, cool.
No, seriously, like, that's my complaint with Tarantino, but 12 Years a Slave was trying to correct that by being very raw and realistic. The problem is, I don't know if that translates into a good movie.
Like,
watching that movie, I felt extremely uncomfortable, but I didn't feel as invested as I would. Part of my complaint, this might be weird, but I just kind of find it strange that they focus on free man who gets captured
But do you think that maybe Steve McQueen, the director, thought that it would be best to try to take a character that came from the class that he thought the majority of his audience would be coming from and try to make him more relatable that way? I mean, you and me can talk about how we didn't think it didn't go deep or dark enough, but I mean, like, you know, somebody who's making over $100,000 a year or whatever, I mean, do you think that they want to watch that extremely dark movie versus this, like, kind of movie that's on the edge of Oscar bait, on the edge of actually having something important to say?
Yeah, and I don't know the answer. I don't think there's a good answer either way. Like, I have no problems with them selecting that person because he went through a traumatic experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real experience that should be told, but it just feels uncomfortable to me, like, that if it was selected to try to appeal to, like, white people or white people of a certain background, like, why? I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if it was. I'm totally putting words in. It is a source material.
Yeah, it's somebody who actually lived to tell that story.
Yeah, yeah.
And their own voice, which mm-hmm. is important.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't sit well with me. I don't know what it was. Like, I have no problems with showing slavery. The whole audience I watched it with were white and old and really uncomfortable. Like, five of them walked out from the theater.
Oof.
Yeah, no shit. And their faces were just so, like, rotten. And
did you say take that?
I was sitting back and I watched them exit and they just looked so pissed off and I was like, that's what this movie's supposed to do, that's good. But
yeah.
At the end of the day, I just didn't feel like I watched a movie. I watched something that was punishing and that was truthful, but I don't know if it was a movie, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that goes to what you think a movie is or should be.
Mm-hmm.
I felt more punished than moved.
Mm-hmm. He probably got his point across then, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess it really depends on what you said, like what you think a good movie is.
Yeah.
I do usually consider, would I rewatch this again? Would I tell someone else if they should watch it? But I'm still intrigued to see the film when I get a chance. So.
I mean, people watch Requiem for a Dream, and that's just nothing but like endless punishment.
Yeah. There's definitely a place. Like, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't watch. We were talking about this earlier. A lot of people wouldn't rewatch Clockwork Orange. You know, it's one of the best films of all time, and I think it's something that almost everyone should see. So maybe 12 Years a Slave sort of falls into this to an extent.
Maybe.
Do you feel like it accurately captures? Well, obviously we wouldn't fucking know. But from what you know of it, do you feel like it accurately captures?
I've read a lot of the books on slavery, but I am just a white dude, and I don't have any first-hand experience. It's all.
Are you sure, Keith? Reach yeah. back real deep. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But from what I can tell, like, it is as realistic as you're probably going to get with
mm-hmm.
a movie. Like, there were some first-hand accounts, people who wrote their own stories, and it seems like they captured that really well. But I guess the only characters I generally cared about, like, the white characters, I'd give a shit about them. Like,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the point. If you're being realistic, they're terrible people. Didn't give a shit about them. I cared about the slave characters mostly. And I cared about secondary characters more than Northup, the main character. There was a really good actress, can't remember her name, but she played one of the female slave characters who, without spoiling anything in the movie, but she's the best part of that movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a hard movie to critique. Like, there's so many different things, and I just didn't know how to feel about it.
It's cold in San Francisco. You're listening to Josh Rouse with Julie Come Out of the Rain. You can check out more of his stuff at joshrouse.com. We kept the rules at bay. I wrote you a long letter. Some things you can't explain. Julie, come out of the rain. It's cold and I can't wait for. All right, we'll do a quick film spotlight on Francis Ha, which is a film that came out this year by Noah Baumbach, Baumbach.
I'm not sure I say his name.
Baumbach. I think it's Noah Baumbach.
Okay.
Yeah. Say it real fast.
Baumbach.
And I think this is the film that we both liked a little bit. You want to tell us about it, Keith? What do you think?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. It's probably my number two of the year. The director's known for other movies like Greenberg and The Squid and the Whale and some others I haven't seen. But it's kind of like he's put himself in the indie director camp, kind of the hipster indie director camp. A lot of his characters, you know, are in, what's that part of Brooklyn where all the hipsters? Williamsburg.
Williamsburg, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of aging guys who like that subculture, and he's really, that director's really reflective on what that subculture does to people and how people change as they grow up. And Francis Hall is pretty much focusing on woman and her friends, the people she meets later, and how the direction she's taking in life, whether or not it fits her, and how she changes in and out of hipsterdom.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much the whole movie. It's like how she adjusts her hipster subculture to the real world.
Or almost just her kind of floatiness, like the way she's kind of floating in life versus actually trying to find a place, an existence or something.
Tell me the story of us.
Again? All right, Francis. We are going to take over the world.
You'll be this awesomely bitchy publishing mogul.
And you'll be this famous modern dancer, and I'll publish a really expensive book about you.
The D-bags we make fun of will put on their coffee tables.
And we'll co-own a vacation apartment in Paris.
And we'll have lovers.
And no children.
And we'll speak at college graduations.
And honorary degrees.
So many honorary degrees.
Yeah, and it centers a lot on things you would predict. Is a lot of the focus is on friendship, which is great. I think that was great that from the beginning it focuses on this friendship between two women. And they don't always talk about men, so that's a great thing.
I kind of annoyed me, actually. I wanted a little bit more man talk. Mm-hmm.
Well, the guys in this movie, especially in the beginning, that boyfriend was a total asshole.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the guy with the cat or whatever dog thing he wanted,
mm-hmm.
and he was just being a dick. Yeah. I thought it was good that the way the character arc for Frances was played out really well, because she started out, she was in this subculture that's largely financed by people coming from wealth, like parents with money, or student loans or something to keep them within these rich neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
She loses access to that money. She's kind of jobless and floating around. She has to crash with guys. And she has to kind of find her way through adulthood. And that involved taking a job she was thrilled about, moving back to her college dorm.
Mm-hmm.
Can
mm-hmm.
you imagine that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, take yourself right now, go back to Denton, go into a college dorm, and do that. That is the most.
That sounds outstanding.
No.
I love those days.
That part of the movie sealed it for me because it's like nobody else has explored something like that. It made me so uncomfortable because I was like imagining, like, what if I went back right now
mm-hmm.
and lost my job and had to deal with that? I could feel like shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it showed how the character matured in the end because she did take the job she felt originally was below her in her dreams and ambitions, but she kind of a little bit of her cake and ate it too. Like, she could still be in a studio, be in dance, and also be a secretary or administrator.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting movie. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, what I like about what I think Noah Baumbach's starting to do is he's sort of taking what the mumblecore genre has been doing for the last decade or so, and he's making it kind of, I guess, mainstreamed, for lack of a better word. I think in a lot of ways he's kind of mixing it even more so than it already was with what Woody Allen did back in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie looks like Manhattan, the film, you know.
Yeah.
It's black and white. It feels like it's almost a modern, well, obviously not the plot line, but the way it looks almost looks like a modern day Manhattan. And I just really well written, really nice, subtle character work that teaches you something about these people without being overblown. I especially like the one character who he's a screenwriter And I think at one point in time, he's trying to get on SNL, and he's like, ah, I gave that up. I'm writing Gremlins 3 now. Yeah. It's one of those movies that I think a lot of people would think is kind of, oh, it's really small, or, you know, it's not Gravity. It does not. Sorry, Heath. I know you still liked it. But, you know, it's not earth-shattering. There's not earth-shattering events in it. But the important thing is that the events in it are earth-shattering to Francis, you know? And that's, at the end of the day, as long as your main character has stakes, it doesn't matter if she's trying to rescue herself from, you know, this asteroid or whatever it is, asteroid attack from outer space or whatever, versus trying to figure out her place in the world, you know? They're both interesting stories.
Yeah, and I feel like we're all going to go through Francis Hall at one point in our lives. Like, I mean, maybe not moving back to college, but we're all going to need to adjust, find a job that we may not match up 100% with what our ambitions are, or, like, what we want to do, our dreams. Like, we have to adjust our dreams to reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that film is great to have, to put that on display for our generation, because, I mean, outside of a few TV shows, we don't see that a lot. Like, people in our generation adjusting to reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always going to be, like, you know, getting what you want.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is a spoiler alert, but with the end of the film, I've been grappling a lot with, was it too easy of an ending for her? Like, is it a realistic ending that she gets, like, this kind of offshoot of what she wanted, you know? Where she ends up, she isn't able to be a dancer, but she's able to be a person who is creating her own dance shows, you know? But I feel to a certain extent that it's important to have that message at the end for people who do find themselves in Frances Ha's, you know, shoes. Because it's nice to see... I mean, films are a lot of things. Films can be eye-opening, like 12 Years a Slave could be. They could also just be, like, inspiring, like, okay, well, Francis can do it, I can do it. And that sounds silly, but at the end of the day, that's what this movie's going to do for some people, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a part of me that wants it to be, like, super realistic, like it already was, and maybe this character wouldn't get that ability, but, you know, she does kind of clean things up and start to realize what she wants out of life and the best way to get it. And understanding her limitations as well.
Yeah, I feel like it wouldn't have been true to the character to end the movie, like, I don't know, she becomes a car detailer or, like, a post office person. She fought hard against getting real jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she really wanted her dream. I think it wouldn't have rang true at the end had she not been somewhat close to her dream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing that I really liked that I want to touch upon is that there's this scene in the film, this is like a small kind of aside, where she goes on this trip to, I guess it's Paris, right?
Yeah.
And it's, for her, it's almost supposed to be this kind of catalyst for change in her life.
Yeah.
And she goes there and she ends up taking some medication, I think, and she ends up sleeping through her entire trip, basically.
Yeah, it's,
yeah, yeah, that's what it was, there's jet lag, yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, she just sleeps through the entire trip. And I thought it was a really good commentary on the fact that you can't just leave where you are and try to escape to some other place to change your life. Like, that can't be the catalyst for change. You have to create that catalyst yourself.
Yeah.
Although that is kind of a turning point for her in the film. But I thought that was kind of saying.
And I also liked how people have this image built up from, like, birth, that your Paris, France is a magical place to
yeah.
go to and, like, change your life. And a character later on talks about Paris, like, oh, I went there in 90 whatever and I saw, you know, so and so and it was great, and she had a terrible experience. I'm like, I think for most people, if you go alone to Paris, you've never been there, you don't speak French, you're probably not gonna have the greatest time. Maybe you do, but for the most part, it'd be like getting adjusted to jet lag,
mm-hmm.
walking around taking pictures, trying to find people to meet up with, being alone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing, that was a big part of that movie, is was constantly alone. Like, she had people she was roommates with, but didn't really connect with them the same way that she did with other people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would you say that she really connected with anybody in the film after her friendship broke up with the bestie?
No, I think it was just her trying to get back to that place with her friend, trying to get back to the safeness and the comfort she felt with her. Yeah. But I liked one. Another thing I liked is to kind of go along with that a little bit. I feel like the movie is a lot about these sort of outward facing ideas of yourself that you put out there in the world.
Yeah.
That's definitely a big part of the Facebook generation, and just constant updates about what you're doing, where you are, who you're hanging out with, these revolutionary ideas you've come up with, things like this. I feel like the movie has a lot to say about the way you present your life versus the actual life you're leading.
Yeah.
Which is kind of seen when I think she has a conversation with her friend. She calls her from Paris, and that's kind of a conversation where she's acting almost like she's had like this great time in Paris, and like,
yeah,
she's just been sleeping the day away.
And it'd be, I guess, interesting if she'd taken like Instagram photos of Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it looks so shiny.
Yeah, yeah.
Reality is much different.
Yeah, exactly.
Film Friend 2013 wrap up.
You want to jump over to the movies you saw in 2013 that weren't 2013 movies?
A few highlights. I saw Badlands for the first time. I always forget the director's name.
Turns out.
Yeah.
T-Mal.
T-Mal. Who I have a conflicted relationship with. I'm not as big a fan of his later movies as Matt is.
And you're wrong for it.
Oh, okay. Like, I tried to get through Tree of Life. I tried to like that movie. And
That's a rebirth movie, just like Gravity. No, not really. But. Yeah, it is very pretty pictures.
But Badlands was interesting. Like, that was his first film?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
it's a tight 90 minutes, which none of the other movies are.
Tight 90 minutes. There's not a plot. There's kind of a plot. Like, people die, and they move to different places, and they get kind of hunted down by law. But it's less plot, more character study about these people who are really... One of them is definitely a sociopath. One of them has not put enough thought into what's going on around her. And I don't think she's necessarily a sociopath. Maybe not. But I really don't. She has this fantasy built up about men and about what happens. And she doesn't realize what's actually happening. Like, the dude murders her family.
Mm-hmm.
And the dude murders all these people. And she's just like, oh, well, might as well go along with him.
He's a James Dean type, though, so he's
yeah.
He's a good catch.
Good catch. He's a great guy. He just killed my father or whatever. Another movie I saw was Amadeus, which was awesome. Really great movie. Not much else to say about that. It was just perfect from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Good script, good cast. All a lot of fun.
Cool, man.
Except for the sad end.
I haven't seen Amadeus, but Badlands is one of my favorites.
Yeah, Badlands is awesome.
Good T-Mel movie. So I'll drop six on you since you asked for it. I'll run through them real quick. So I got Crimes and Misdemeanors, which is a Woody Allen film from the 90s. Or maybe, I think it's actually 80s. Maybe 89. Anyway, a really great film. Terrific. It's kind of, I was telling you earlier, it's kind of Dostoevskian, maybe is the word for it. But I just think it had a great mix of Woody Allen's dramatic stuff and his comedic stuff. Another one is Shotgun Stories, which is from the same director who did Mud. His name is Jeff Nichols. He did Mud. He also did last year's
Take Shelter.
Exactly. Thank you.
It was my top five.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen Shotgun Stories, which is fantastic. It's his first film. It's just sort of basically a character piece about the main character played by Michael Shannon, who's gone on to do much bigger stuff. He was in The Summer's Man of Steel. And it just sort of takes a look at him and some of his brothers. Another film was Wet Hot American Summer, which is kind of a cult flick now, comedy cult flick. A lot of the guys from The State, which is a sketch show in the 90s, if you're aware of that. Michael Ian Black, one of the main characters in this film. Michael Showalter, directed by David Wayne. It's a hilarious movie. It felt like one of the films that, felt like a film that me and my friends would have made in high school.
Yeah.
They're just a perfect mix of really absurd comedy, and actually, I guess there's really not anything else. Just mainly, just really absurd comedy. And
Paul Rudd,
yeah,
playing the best part he's ever played.
He that really is one of the best roles ever. I love. I don't know. It's like, it's a really dumb movie, but it's a really smart movie at the same time. Like, all the jokes are really dumb,
yeah,
but they have like a smartness to them.
Yeah.
Paul Rudd's character is like this he just like will knock stuff over, and he always gets his way because he's like the hot guy that everyone wants to be with. But it's such a good critique of like, what would that guy really be like in real life? He'd be an asshole, and he would just be basically whiny. You know what I mean?
When he knocks over the food, and then
Janine Garofalo makes him pick it up.
Yeah, and he's like,
dude, it's so good. And I only mentioned like three or four actors, but there's so many people in this movie, and you just keep seeing faces that you've seen now, like Bradley Cooper's in it, Amy Poehler, Janine Garofalo, as I mentioned. I don't remember his name, the brother on Frasier, he's in it. But anyway, it's fantastic. It's totally, if you're into any, I don't care what kind of comedy movies, like, you should be watching this movie. It's awesome, yeah. One more, drop on you, The Long Goodbye, which is a Robert Altman flick from the 70s. I call him Flick, so I'm a cool guy. It's like a modern, where's the 1970s modern day noir. And I just liked it because it was a movie that was pretty ambiguous, and it was happy having a kind of confusing ending that doesn't really tell you how you should feel either way, which I think kind of goes against some of the other things in that genre. Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee film, yeah. His second rate.
Something.
Yeah. The first time I'd seen this one, it was amazing.
That's in my, like, top 10 or 20 movies. So.
Yeah, it's definitely very close to mine. Of all time for you?
Yeah. Spike Lee has yet to make as good a movie.
It happens. Most of these directors, like, the first or second film, like, the best one.
Yeah.
But what I really would do the right thing is it's a great mixture of, you know, it's a good story, there's interesting characters, there's something that he's trying to say, and, like, the shots are just, like, crazy. They're off the wall, like, some of the stuff he's doing, you know what I mean? It's awesome.
Like, that's a movie, if you want to talk about character, like, every character in that movie is a character.
Is unique, yes. Yeah.
They stand out, you can kind of predict how they're going to behave.
Mm-hmm.
When the ending happens, it all makes sense, but it's still interesting, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, why do they keep doing stuff like that?
I don't know, man.
Said old boy.
And the last one I'll mention that I saw this year that was new for me was Slacker, Richard Linklater's first film. Actually shot here in Austin, so it's a hometown feature. And there's actually pretty cool. You can see the, you know, locales. I kept seeing areas and like, do I know where that is? But this was shot in like 1991.
Okay.
So things have changed a lot since then. But a really awesome movie. There's no point. There's no plot line. It goes in and out between characters. It does this thing that I always thought would be this original idea I had, which was every minute devoted to a different character and just move to a different character. That's not exactly what this does. It gives more like 3 or 4 minutes to each character, but it's pretty much the same thing. So my idea is not original whatsoever. It's pretty awesome, man. It's if you like the Before movies, which we were discussing earlier, you'll like this because it's very dialogue heavy. If you like Linklater's dialogue work, you'll like this a lot.
I don't think you can hate most Richard Linklater films. Like, there are very few that you can hate.
I've heard of a few, but I haven't seen them. Like, I heard, I don't even remember which ones I heard.
Squirrel Rock or
no, Squirrel Rock's amazing.
I thought that was great.
I think it was maybe the Bears one, the Bears remake he made.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's a baseball movie with the kids.
Oh. Whatever.
The Berenstain Bears.
Well, he's really good, though. I think he's going to go down as one of the greats because of the Before movies.
Like, yeah, man. He, like you mentioned, it is really hard. There aren't too many of his movies that have turned out badly, so he just has a good au revoir.
I am a woman of leisure. I've been looking for the end of one.
This is Tao and the Get Down Stay Down with Holy Ruler. You can check out their stuff at Tao and the Get Down Stay Down.com. We're going to wrap it up with our top five of 2013. Blowout of the year.
Do it,
Keith. Hit it.
Number five is a tie because I want to be that guy.
I was that guy in the entire show.
Okay. Well, number five for me is either Blue Jasmine by Woody Allen or Blue Caprice.
The
Blue Duo of number five.
Cool.
The Preferences, I haven't seen all the good movies, so I haven't seen Inside Llewyn Davis. I haven't seen all the stuff Matt's going to talk about. So, yeah, it'll change. But Number four, Beyond the Hills, Romanian film, director who did 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, I can't remember what it is, but yeah, Beyond the Hills was great, and it's a little bit slow going, but when it hits you, it disturbs the crap out of you.
Mm.
Number three, The Act of Killing, another extremely disturbing documentary, which I recommend everybody see, and then take 5 showers and try to forget about. Number two, Francis Ha. Number one, Gravity, which I know you love. You're the biggest fan of Gravity ever.
Love it. It was changed my life, actually.
Yeah.
I after I saw Gravity, decided to never watch another film again because I got everything I needed in that one.
Everything in that one film.
So I just rewatch it over and over and over again. Real quick, before you mind, do you want to drop on any thoughts on any of those in particular? If you don't, that's cool.
If I had to push y'all to watch anything, check out Beyond the Hills. It's shot in a way that makes a lot of American viewers uncomfortable because it's got long takes. There's not a lot of quick cuts, not a lot of moving camera, but if you get used to the rhythm and you get halfway through the movie, I guarantee you'll like it. And especially the way it ends, it's got a really perfect ending that nails like everything in the movie. So.
Mm-hmm. That's probably one that not a lot of people, I mean, I've seen it mentioned before, but it's not getting as much attention as like Gravity or, you know, Inside Llewyn Davis or.
Yeah. It's not an easy movie to watch. Like, it takes a while to get used to his pace, but once you do, it's worth it.
And it's foreign, right? It's
Yeah, Romanian film.
Romanian, okay.
Yeah.
I guess I've been hearing about a lot of films coming out of Romania these days. Is it Romanian? I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
The Roma people are in different parts of the.
Okay. So what before we jump on mine real quick, what do you think are some of the trends you've seen in film this year? And do you think it was like a good year in film?
It was a great year in film just because there was a big diversity in what I could watch and could enjoy. Like on my list, Gravity,
mm-hmm.
which is totally
sci-fi.
Different than Francis Ha. Like,
but
different films.
Is it?
Yeah. they both kind of star women. They're both about transformation.
Yeah, they kind of are. They're both about a woman like having a rebirth.
That's true. Well, good job.
I can tie anything together.
Yeah. Welcome to English. No. but as far as themes, like, it was all over the board. I mean, Inside Llewyn Davis was about folk rock. About folk, not rock. But I don't know. There's so many different, like, Her. I have yet to see Her, but.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff. I'm glad that there's a diversity.
Mm-hmm. And then 12 Years a Slave is totally different from any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. I noticed that there were two kind of topics that were touched on a lot, which was end of the world, mm-hmm. right? There are a lot of movies about, well, I guess I could mainly think about three that were about end of the world. And then there's a lot of movies about entitlement, which brings me to my top five.
Oh, well.
And like Keith, there's been too many that I've yet to see, outside of my top five that I'd like to mention would be Computer Chess, Drink Buddies, and Much Ado About Nothing. Did you see the Much Ado About Nothing?
No, I heard it was good, though.
It's good, man. Yeah. I heard some people say that it wasn't shot very well, which angered me because there are like two shots in that movie that are bloody brilliant looking.
Cool.
Drinking Buddies is awesome. Have a nice beer with it and then consider if you're an alcoholic and get depressed. And Computer Chess you saw, which is pretty amazing.
Computer Chess was tricky.
I definitely like Computer Chess a lot. I just couldn't, as they say, I couldn't crack it into my top five.
Yeah, it's. I like how adventurous that movie is. Like, you don't see a lot of movies that take risks like that.
Yeah. It's like shot on the 80s camcorder or something, right?
I think it was a 1960s or something, old ass camcorder that gives you that really.
Yeah. All right, cool. So my top five and number five was Prince Avalanche, which was David Gordon Green's new movie. It was amazingly awesome. Kind of surprised me too to an extent because I have actually never seen any of his movies before this one besides Pineapple Express. But I knew that he had done a lot of some of the more popular mumblecore films. And that he had sort of, I guess, in some critics' opinions, fallen off the wagon with Pineapple Express. He did a movie after that, some stoner comedy. I don't remember what it's called. Like, Your Highness, I think is what it's called. And so this is kind of a return to form. It's just a real quiet movie about two guys who are working amongst this burnt out landscape in Texas. And they're just painting the yellow lines on the road. So it's a really simple movie. Not a whole lot happens. But just kind of a character piece, much like Francis Ha, which is my fourth favorite film of the year. We already talked about it.
You're going to hate me if I say Prince Avalanche was my disappointment.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
What were you disappointed about?
See, I liked it. I like the ideas. I love Paul Rudd. Like, I don't think you can hate Paul Rudd. It's really hard to hate Paul Rudd.
Uh-huh.
And I liked watching him on screen. And some of the character moments were interesting, but I felt like, I guess there wasn't enough conflict that I cared about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to do that. But
that's not really spoiling anything because, I mean, yeah. It's really dependent on how you interpret it. Like, I didn't interpret it that way.
I like the multiple interpretations.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, there's definitely a scene that you have to believe is not of this world.
Yeah. There are certain scenes.
Yeah, and that made it interesting, but I guess overall, like, I just wanted more to hang on to and more to happen. Like, I wanted to know more about the characters. I was interested in the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted more to happen, I guess.
I felt like there was enough conflict for me with everything between Paul Rudd and his lady friend and Emil Hirsch and his lady friends. I mean, I like it because it's, in a lot of ways, they're in one setting, you know what I mean? Like, it's different shots from that setting because they're over this entire landscape that's kind of burnt out behind them, right?
Yeah.
Forestry has just been burned out or whatever by these fires. But in the long run, they're in one place because they're not really able to do much more than what they're doing.
Yeah.
I just thought it was interesting. I don't know. That'd be good.
I need to probably rewatch it and see how I feel.
Yeah, and it felt like one of those films where I can't quite explain what it's getting at, but it feels like there's more under the surface than you're just seeing, which I really appreciate stuff like that. And maybe that's just because I like putting all sorts of interpretations on stuff. So when it's open-ended, it's like my cheesecake, but
yeah.
that's my cheesecake, baby. It's my cheesecake.
Yeah, too. Cheese. No, I'll rewatch that one, but keep going.
Yeah, okay. So, Francis Hama number 4. We already talked about that. Before Midnight was my number 3.
Mm-hmm.
I really like this movie because I like the first two Before films. And I think Keith, you said this one was kind of conflicting for you because, what was it?
Well, I think it's a necessary correction to the super optimistic endings of the last two films.
Mm-hmm.
It's more realistic, and that's probably how a lot of marriages end up. Like, fast forward 20 years down the road, maybe you cheated, maybe you just got tired of each other, maybe you had kids, maybe you don't feel sexy, and you fight, and blah, blah, blah. And that's probably realistic, but I don't know what it was. Like, when I watched the first two Before movies, I felt like...
You believed in love?
Mm-hmm. Like, I was ready, like, I want to find a French girl and, you know, go travel the world, and I don't know.
But I think that what you're not seeing is, I would argue that Before Midnight actually is a hopeful movie.
Yeah.
I think it has a lot of shit that it goes through, but I think by the end of it, and I guess this is kind of spoilerish, but again, but by the end of it, you have these two individuals, you've had this big fight, they said some really awful things to one another, you know,
mm-hmm.
but they're still both there at the end of the night, together, ready to, like, you know, push forward and try for another 7 years, you know,
yeah.
or how many years is between the movies. I think that Linklater said, okay, this is what it's like before you get into a relationship. You know, this is, like, the dreamy, romantic side of it, and these are the realities of a relationship. You don't see eye to eye sometimes, and you have to work through that, and you can't just get your way all the time, and the other person can't just get their way all the time. There's going to be conflict, and if you can make it through that conflict at the end of the night and you still want to spend time together, then you are in love.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
I totally agree with you, and I don't think it's a totally pessimistic film at the end at all.
Uh-huh.
I think these characters are destined to repeat this over and over. Like,
yeah.
They're such independent-minded people that
uh-huh.
they might be healed for the short term, but long term, like, this is going to happen over and over. Like, I think they had a great time together, but I don't know if these guys should be
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like they could each be happier if maybe they found somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird thing. But
interesting.
It's weird for me to say that because I enjoy the ride, like, getting here so much with just them talking. It makes them so unique. But, it's like, I wouldn't know what to do if I was in his shoes and I had said the things I had said and she'd said the things she had said. And I was faced with, do I want to keep going? I don't know, maybe it's the young me talking, but I feel like time to call quits or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Don't you think that'd be just him giving up, though?
Well, I don't think that character wants to give up. And he says as much in the film. Like, he goes back out there to try to, in his way, repair things a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But you don't think he should?
I don't know. I mean, I just wonder how much happier they would be at this point in their lives to separate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The dating pool is shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know. I just feel like maybe those guys need a break or something.
Mm-hmm.
It really had it rough.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I totally bought that relationship.
It was a good movie. Like, I don't regret watching it. And I just... The only thing that kind of made me question it a little bit was the dinner scene they had with the Greek family.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of felt out of place, I guess.
Yeah, a little bit. But I know what it was saying because it was wanting you to focus on the young couple that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And contrast that with, Ethan Hawke and what's the actress?
Julie Delpy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's before midnight.
Cool, man. Loved it. It was great. All right, sweet. My number two is a heavily derided film, Spring Breakers, which a lot of people hate, and... All I can say is that, like, this movie totally tripped me out of what it had to say about the entitlement of the younger class of Americans. And you really have to see it and decide for yourself at the end of the day, because some people seem to think that it's about, you know, taking these Disney girls and turning them to sexual objects or whatever. I think it's a lot more than about that, you know.
Open your mouth, bitch.
I was in the car. I was sitting there looking out for all the motherfucking police. And we in the back, we just open the door and we go, freeze, motherfuckers! Hands on the motherfucking
knees! Get your motherfucking knees on the motherfucking ground, you piece of shit!
Those motherfuckers, down, motherfucker, down! Get on your fucking knees, Faith, get on your fucking knees! Get your motherfucking knees on the fucking ground!
What'd they do?
They fucking got on the ground.
It's just fantastic. It has so much to say about class disparities currently and the way that people in the upper class are just kind of able to dip their toes into this dangerous world and they have the ability to get themselves out of it. But what does that mean for the people who don't have that same ability, you know? And I don't know. I'm totally into the entitlement thing this year. I loved it. Any movie that was about entitlement, I was pretty much into. I can't.
It was called Entitlement.
Yeah, Entitlement was really good too. Yeah. I can't think of what I haven't liked so far. Yeah, that hit me.
The Bling Ring?
I like The Bling Ring. It's not my top 10 or anything, but it was so good. Some people like it better than this one, which I hardcore disagree with. What's interesting about The Bling Ring is that it has more to say about what Facebook plays in all this stuff, and which I think has a pretty big part in it. But this movie has nothing to say about social media, which is kind of weird. But besides that, it's really good. You know, it's just all about the vapidness of spring break. And
I was thinking about this the other day, but The Social Network, the Fincher movie,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really have a ton to say about Facebook. I mean, other than, like, the obsession that can happen sometimes and the realities don't match up. But I think that movie's more about people and characters than it was about Facebook, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think what it's saying about Facebook is kind of in the background, which is that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg might have 5 million friends, but how many friends does he really have?
Yeah.
My number one film was Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, yeah.
My boy, the Coen brothers, dropping it down. So this is their first film since True Grits, which came out a few years ago. And I think it's their best movie in a while. Initially I said it was their best movie since No Country for Old Men, but I think it's actually better than that one. Dropping it on you for real.
Bold words.
It's definitely a different movie. I mean, you know, when you're comparing movies, it's kind of half-assed because everything's a little bit different. But I loved it. I mean, I love the feel of it. I love the time period, the 60s, and the folk movement really early on. This is basically right before Dylan. So it just has, it's an interesting time period. And I don't necessarily know that all the characters besides Llewyn Davis are fleshed out entirely well. I mean, there's definitely good characters in the film, specifically
John Goodman's
fantastic in this movie. Yeah, John Goodman's a good character, but it's very much a side character. You know, he's in a lot of the Coen Brothers movies, you have characters that kind of go on a journey of sorts,
yeah.
And this has a segment that's kind of like that, and John Goodman's a part of that journey. I'm not trying to spoil it. He dies. Yeah. No, I'm not trying to spoil it. But I guess what I'm getting at is that Llewyn Davis is one of the best characters I've seen in a long time. And a lot of people are talking about how much of an asshole he is and stuff like this. But I totally related to him in some ways. Just the way that he sees his creative works and creativity in general, and the importance he puts behind them, and the importance he puts in not compromising himself. There are times when he compromises himself in the film, but generally I feel like at the end of the day he's trying to do what he feels is right for his craft.
I guess the sad part, I haven't spoiled anything for me, but I know that he's kind of before his time, you know, like Dylan comes after him and here's a guy that stays true to his craft, but he doesn't get rewarded for it.
Well, not spoiling anything, but it's definitely a movie about being in the right place at the right time. And that sort of thing, and all the bands you've never heard of and will never hear of from the 60s, or all the musicians you will never hear of, who have so much talent, it's just some guy in a suit thought they didn't have it, you know what I mean? The same goes for film, writing, anything pretty much is the same for all artists, and just it's a movie about artists, and I just think it's really terrific. It has a great mix of, it's a very modern film, even though it's about the 60s. I think it has a lot to say about the times we're in now to an extent. And while it's very modern, it also has kind of a classic Hollywood feel to it, which I think the Coen brothers are really good at, is making movies that are in their time,
yeah,
but still having so many ties to like the best movies of the Hollywood. Yeah, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a genre film, but it's shot so well, it's written so well. You know, it's not experimental necessarily, but it's still new, if that makes any sense.
What would an experimental Coen Brothers film look like? I guess
they've had to have had one.
The Man Who Wasn't There, that's the closest I've seen.
Yeah. I guess Burn After Reading is kind of out there a little bit. I mean, it's not like super weird, but
that movie's just a big middle finger.
Yeah.
That was their punk song.
Yeah. You're like, No Country for Old Men? Fuck you. The Colden Brothers.
The Coen Brothers. I haven't seen the movie yet, but their movies consistently, I don't know how to rank them. They're probably in my top 10 or 20.
Yeah.
At least 80% of their work is up there in the top 20 or 30.
Yeah, they have the Lady Killers, but they also have some the best movies of the last 20 years, Raising Arizona.
They never made the Lady Killers.
It never happened. Star Wars style.
Yeah.
You forgot about the Lady Killers. And that'll wrap up the inaugural episode of the Film Fringe Podcast. We'd like to thank you guys for checking us out. We hope you come back in 2 weeks when we'll be reviewing Zero Charisma, a film shot here in Austin, as well as Paul Thomas Anderson's 2008 film, There Will Be Blood. Lastly, we'll be talking about our most anticipated films of 2014, so definitely come back and check that out. We'd like to thank our good bud, Dennis Harvey, for this theme song, Geronimo. And we'd also lastly like to thank Rachel Manning for her catering services and the production of this podcast. Thanks, guys. And whatever you do, stay fringy. Peace out, Internet. Bye, Internet.
Goodbye. Have a good one.
All right. See you later, Internet.
Take it easy out there.
Internet.